welcome back to the Holistic Nutritionist Podcast. My name's Natalie Douglas and I am your host, and I cannot believe it's 2021. How freaking crazy. Before I jump in and introduce today's guest, I just wanted to remind you of some really exciting upcoming offers and things available for you to be part of in the coming few months. So first of all, I have an amazing program called Gut Rescue launching in February. So if you are someone who has bloating, discomfort, constipation, loose stools, food intolerances galore, then you're going to want to be a part of this. So please make sure that you sign up to the wait list via the link in my Instagram bio, or head to nataliekdouglas.com and click on the link that says Gut Rescue up the top. And there's loads of information, there's a wait list, and there will also be an invitation to join a free masterclass very shortly. But I will share more of that in the coming weeks over on my Instagram as well. The other really exciting thing is that another round of Thyroid Rescue, which is my signature thyroid healing program, is going to begin in March. So again, you can head to the link in my Instagram bio or my website to find out more about that and how you can be part of the first round in 2021. Okay, so on to introducing today's guest to you guys. Shannon Carlin is, well, I'll give you her formal bio in a moment, but what I wanted to share with you first is that Shannon, for those of you who are longtime podcast listeners, Shannon was actually part of Kate's team of practitioners that supported her through her own breast cancer journey. And Kate could not speak more highly of her. And I know that if Kate were still here with us on Earthside, she would be absolutely on this podcast interviewing and sharing Shannon's message and her knowledge with you as well. So in my effort to carry on Kate's dedication to this area and to carry on her message and to carry on her, you know, very passionate, I guess, dedication to sharing other people's skills and expertise, I invited Shannon on the podcast to give us a little bit more information about all things breast cancer and natural medicine alongside that. So now for a bit of a formal background to Shannon, for those of you who don't know who she is, Shannon provides adjunctive oncology care for patients who have received a breast cancer diagnosis, as well as other hormonally driven cancers, supporting those undergoing conventional oncology medicine treatments. Shannon is so passionate about reducing the side effects of treatment short term and the possible longer term side effects of treatment. Shannon works alongside oncologists, sharing the care and communicating treatment plans. Due to her experience with her mother, who received a cancer diagnosis some 20 years ago, Shannon has a unique approach and particular interest in working with cancer patients. Shannon has extensive experience working with breast cancer patients at various stages of their diagnosis. Through chemotherapy, she works to improve quality of life, including reducing the effects of mucositis, nausea, diarrhea, peripheral neuropathy, anxiety, and fatigue. And patients are often surprised with how well they are coping and their ability to work and lead a normal life during these times. Shannon has seen positive results in reducing the side effects of hormonal treatments such as tamoxifen and Arimidex, which you guys may or may not know what I'm talking about. But, you know, these are all just ways that she has been able to support so many of her patients that she has seen. So without giving you loads more information about her, I just wanted to also share that she is someone who is highly regarded in our naturopathic and nutrition therapy industry, and someone who I think has such a unique ability to meet people where they are at, and is someone that I'm so excited to share more with you about. So I'm going to pop the rest of Shannon's information and bio in the show notes of this episode. And in the meantime, let's jump in and start this conversation. everyone, and welcome to the Holistic Nutritionist Podcast. Thank you so much for being here with us today, and I'm really excited to explore this area of health with you, or challenge of health with you, because it's not one that I personally treat at all, really. And so I love that we're able to have you on to share a little bit more information about hopefully something that people don't need to learn about ever, but you know, it's really good to have to start the conversation around breast cancer and awareness of it as well. And I know that's exactly what Kate would be doing if she was still with us here. So the first question I wanted to just touch base with you on is, what is something that's inspiring you or interesting you in the world of natural medicine at the moment?
Okay, a couple of things, I guess. Closer to home is what's going on with the registration or the application for registration for naturopathy and Western herbal medicine, which is brewing, and there's lots of energy behind that at the moment. And that's exciting for all naturopaths, herbalists, because it just means such a big shift in how our, or I feel anyway, how our modality is perceived by the general public, by people, clients who come to see us. Like we're the only, I believe, we're the only government accredited degree level modality profession which is excluded from private health insurance rebates. And private health insurance is a big, it provides, it's that recognition, I suppose. And I get asked by a lot of clients, you know, do you take, or, you know, I've got private health cover, can you take that for me? And when you say that we can't, naturopathy isn't covered, it can have, in some instances, not all, a bit of an impact on the perception of what we do and how we're valued. So I'm a bit excited about that.
Yeah, it's crazy thinking about it, isn't it? Because I just think some of the most intelligent people I know are naturopaths. Yeah. And, you know, I know a lot of smart people. So yeah, I just really think, you know, they're such a passionate, knowledge-hungry, compassionate group of people for the most part. And obviously that's a generalization. I'm speaking from the ones that I know. But it just, yeah, blows my mind. But I think there is a push towards that, even from the public. I feel like there are more people seeking quote unquote alternate medicine services such as naturopathy or acupuncture, all these different things. And I just think, like, why exclude just naturopaths and herbalists and stuff? It just seems nuts.
I'm so pleased that you feel that way. I concur with everything that you've said, and we've got some really bright, clever, experienced people at the realm of this movement. So it's exciting. Watch this space, I suppose, for all of us, and see what happens. Absolutely. And the other thing, Nat, that's a pretty exciting, which isn't just naturopathy, but is the shift to, I feel like there's a shift at the moment with the from the paradigm that there's just one approach to treating cancer, and there's a lot going into immunotherapies and that whole shift of thinking of what cancer is and how we treat it, and perhaps the last 70 odd years of treating it the way we have isn't doing what it should be doing and isn't ideal, and that there are other ways to treat it. So that's pretty exciting too. So I think in the next few years we'll see a lot more, a big change, a big shift in cancer and how we perceive it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there should be, because I mean, I know even when Kate, bless her, when she got diagnosed and bought the biggest possible book on cancer, evidence-based cancer, she'll be laughing as I'm saying this. Yeah. You know, there's just so much out there that you can access that does have evidence around it that is not being commonly used. And as you kind of said, it's not necessarily about one approach over the other. It's about, well, you know, what are all the things on offer here and what is best suited to this patient at this time, and what are we learning and can we continue to adapt as new information, new technologies, new, you know, findings, understandings come in and adjust, as opposed to it being this real protocol type approach that it has been. And I mean, I say that, obviously, take it with a grain of salt. I'm not in that industry, but from the outside looking in, that's what it seems like.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's not one cancer that's the same, and yet there's a, you know, treatments that treat that one cancer, and there's no one body that's the same, and what's going on in that body, not just the cancer itself, there's a lot more to it about that terrain and about that environment, for which is very individual. So it makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I love how you put that, because it's so true, and often it's honed in on as here's a disease state, but what about the whole person experiencing that disease? So I love that. And today we're chatting specifically about breast cancer, and I feel like this is a topic that can be incredibly confusing and confronting. And so I really wanted to start the conversation around it, just to get people a general understanding about some of, you know, the lingo, so to speak, that gets thrown around, and understanding what different types kind of mean in a broad sense. Because I think part of the fear is not understanding as well, and all these big words get thrown around, and it's like, well, shit, that sounds bad. And it is, but also understanding something, at least in my own experience, I feel like just is calming. So let's just start with, you know, breast cancer in relation to when it's talked about as hormone positive or negative, or the different types. Like, how would you explain what it means when someone, when they're diagnosed with something that's positive or negative in relation to the hormones?
Yeah, okay. And often when clients are given their histology or histopathology report, and it will have a lot of big words in there and a lot of detail, and then there'll be a section that says, you know, ER positive or negative and what percent, PR positive or negative and what percent, and whether there's the HER2 component or whether it's triple negative, which is none of the above. So majority of breast cancers, about 70%, are estrogen receptor positive and progesterone receptor positive, or one or the other. Majority is estrogen receptor positive. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that the cancer cells, the breast cancer cells, are getting signals from the estrogen and or progesterone to help promote their growth. So it's hormonally driven, hormonally fueled. And then there, it could also be HER2 positive. So that would be triple positive, with the estrogen receptor positive, progesterone receptor positive, and HER2 positive. And HER2 isn't a hormone. It's an acronym for human epidermal growth factor receptor 2. And it's a protein, or sometimes referred to as an oncogene, and it works differently to the hormones in that it's not necessarily fueling it, but the receptors aren't working properly, so it makes too many copies of itself, and then those messages cause the breast cancer cells to grow and to divide uncontrollably. So when you have the HER2 component as well, it can be a more aggressive breast cancer, which you can imagine if it's being fueled or driven by, you know, two different, a protein like that, and also hormones. HER2 is about 25%, accounts for about 25% of breast cancer diagnosis. And then you've got triple negative, which accounts for 10 to 20%. The research is anywhere between there, which means the breast cancer itself isn't being fueled by hormones, and it isn't being fueled or driven by the HER2 receptor.
And do we know what it is being driven by, if in that case, or is it like, where is it one of those situations where we don't know?
No, we don't know. But on the flip side to that, I suppose, is that they do have drugs, medications, chemos, targeted therapies, which are able to control that HER2 from over-replicating itself. So it can be managed once it's understood whether it is positive or not.
Interesting. And thank you for explaining all of that, because that makes a whole bunch more sense and demystifies some of it as well, because I can imagine, as you said, someone getting that report and just being like, what is this? Yeah. What I do not understand. And, you know, I can imagine also receiving a diagnosis, whenever you receive bad news, it's you're not fully switched on and taking in everything that they say. So I can imagine that it's just, yeah, incredibly overwhelming. Yeah. So from a natural medicine perspective or a naturopathic perspective, you know, do the different types of cancer change the kind of dietary approach that you would take with one of your clients? So say, does it change whether someone is hormone positive or, estrogen positive versus progesterone, or is there some real commonalities between what you prescribe when cancer is something that you're treating someone for?
Good question. So from, I guess it depends from at what stage someone has come to seek guidance and support from me. So if it's through chemotherapy, radiation treatment, then the approach is quite similar. But then ongoing, when it's a hormonally fueled or hormonally driven cancer, then you want to be ensuring that or supporting the body in detoxifying any excess hormone production. So supporting those liver pathways. Also looking at foods which may or may not contribute, and also looking at external factors as well, which isn't part of this question, but, you know, being exposed to estrogens which are exogenous or outside of the body. So that comes into play as well. When it's a triple negative diagnosis, because we don't necessarily know definitively what it is that could have created the opportunity for that cancer to start in the first place, it's then about looking or delving a little bit deeper into that person's environment, their background, their history, and their pathology to see whether there are perhaps some things like thyroid function which may have contributed, diabetes or insulin resistance. So therefore your dietary recommendations would be more specific along those lines. But as a general rule, I tend to look at either a plant-based diet or a Mediterranean-style diet with modifications. So and talking Mediterranean, it's probably more a pescatarian. So pescatarian, so vegetarian plus fish. There's some mixed research on eggs with some particular cancers, but working from that style of diet plan where it is predominantly plant-based is going to provide or help reduce any inflammation in the body, provides your body with adequate amounts of antioxidants, high fiber, helps to support that healthy gut microbiome. So again, focusing on that immune modulation and also packed with all those beautiful phytonutrients and polyphenols. So I suppose to answer your question, which I haven't, I'm going a bit round in circles, but it doesn't differ significantly, but we would be focusing, probably adding things in, foods like that are sulfur-rich foods or sulforaphane-rich foods, which help with the detoxification of estrogens in the body if it's an estrogen-driven condition.
Yeah, and so some practical examples of that come to mind for me would be things like broccoli, like cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, yes, cauliflower, yep, kale. Do you find yourself using broccoli sprout powder at all as something that people can add to smoothies, or do you more focus on like whole food versions of them?
It depends on the client. You're able to get more bang for your buck with the broccoli sprout powders, and it's a more, you know, it's more nutrient dense, so you're getting greater levels of that sulforaphane. So that's optimal in many situations. But for some clients who just want to keep that supplement regime to a minimum or have financial constraints, then we have the option of, you know, growing your own broccoli sprouts and eating more of those cruciferous vegetables, and whether you get them in through juices to help with the intake. So it can vary depending.
Yes. I don't know about you, but I've tried to have just straight broccoli sprout powder. Oh my goodness. It was terrible. You have to hide it. You have to hide it, friends.
You have to hide it. Yes. Yeah. Or there's a couple of nice greens powders around which have got some other bits and pieces in it which help with the flavor as well. But yeah, you're exactly right. Yeah.
There's just some things that we prescribe that you've just got to treat like medicine as opposed to something that's enjoyable, I think.
And you've got to try it yourself so that you can say, and I do, I put it out there up front, look, this is not going to be great, but these are the benefits. But if you really can't do it, and some people can't, you know, some of us have weaker stomachs than others, and just that taste or even the smell can be quite nauseating. So yeah, we have options. We work around it.
Yeah, totally. I love that. Okay. And you said at the beginning there that, you know, it might change a little bit if someone's going through chemo and radiotherapy. Is there any like little tweaks that you either have to make, do make? And has it got to do with people needing to keep their energy intake up, or has it got to do with the like nausea that people can feel? What is the changes that are usually made there if there are any?
Yeah, and I find the most challenging part of my supportive role through chemotherapy is you want to be having those beautiful, clean, plant-based diets with, you know, when we say plant-based, we're not talking just having not getting enough protein, but nice low GI protein-rich meals so that and regular, so that you can help reduce that incidence and severity of the nausea. But often people just want the naughty foods, the carbs and things that are just going to help psychologically help with that nausea, and they may appear or feel like that they're going to help, but they don't. They end up making you feel worse. So you might not feel like that nice little protein ball or a handful of nuts and seeds or a smoothie, but those foods in small amounts regularly are going to help with, as I said, with that nausea. So it's more about pulling some foods, because through chemo, your body's working really hard to deal with this onslaught of medications, and that's what it is. And it's a big oxidative onslaught as well. So whatever we can do to help reduce inflammation and support that digestive function is going to help reduce side effects of chemo. So we may pull foods that they may normally regularly eat, but by doing that, they will feel better, you know, through their treatment. So it's difficult. It's really difficult. And I know often clients will say, oh gosh, you know, I have to admit I didn't do that. I had this. I was just so drawn to it. But yeah, I did feel rubbish afterwards. So it's a bit of, you know, we do our best as we can. There's recommendations, and sometimes we fall, and sometimes we don't follow them 100%. But I try to stress how important it is for the body to recover as well, and to get through the chemo with a quite restricted diet.
Yeah, and I can imagine it's that balance between, doing your absolute best and meeting yourself where you're at. It sounds a bit like what I tell people who are going through trimester one, really nauseous and just about the times where you're not feeling overwhelmingly nauseous, try and use that as the time where you get, you know, really nutrient dense meal in, and try and hide things in different things, and get someone else to do some of the cooking for you, because often that smell of cooking can just create that issue.
Yeah. And pre-preparing too, like ask people, because everyone, you know, family and friends are going to want to help. And I think cooking is such a beautiful way to show your love and how much you care. And if you can be quite defined with what type of foods that you're wanting to have, people are really happy to make those foods for you. And that makes all the difference too, because the last thing you want to be doing on some days post chemo is thinking of what to eat, shopping for what you need to cook, and trying to get that good food into you. And like you said, you mentioned before too, with some clients, we don't want them to lose too much weight. Mm-hmm. So it's that fine balance as well, that we want to maintain a good nutrient dense calorie intake.
Yeah, and I can tell you, as someone who's been on the inside of a hospital ward in the oncology department, I actually did part of my dietetics clinical placement there, and granted this was many years ago, but the advice there was just doesn't matter as long as they're eating a lot of calories. And I just, even back then, when I didn't know necessarily everything I know now, I was like, surely that doesn't make sense. Like, I get that, yes, we need to make sure we get enough food in, but is there not even any hint at quality matters? Because it just makes sense. Like, as you said, your body is going through so much and your mind's going through so much, and we know that food has an impact, and it's not just about calories and energy intake.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of if you've got a small child, excuse me, and, you know, you love your child and you want them to be happy, and they're like, "Mom, please, can't I just have lollies for lunch?" And yeah, as much as you want to please them, you know that you wouldn't give them lollies for lunch. You'd make them something nutritious, and you know, educate them about why, and make things that are yummy and nutritious as well. And it's similar to that process. I think it's that mentality of perhaps trying to make things easier because, yes, you know, cancer patients going through chemotherapy, that's, you know, that is huge, and it can be really difficult. And so by being able to then not take away anything else, I suppose, or make it any harder, is to indulge in whatever it is that's brought around during their chemo treatments. And often people are just after the knowledge, you know. Unless you've been there, or unless you work in this area, you might not necessarily know or understand. We're all learning, and if you haven't done it, you haven't been there, then you just may not know what is the best best food choice for you through chemo, but also, you know, in recovering afterwards.
Absolutely. And speaking of not knowing, or different things that are floating out there, so I have a couple of questions for you that I know will come up. And one is, what are your thoughts on the ketogenic diet for cancer? Because I feel that on the interwebs, there is the two camps. It's either 100% plant-based or keto, and don't even look at a carb. So we've kind of touched on the plant-based and you being an advocate for filling most of your diet with plant-based foods. What about keto? Do you have much even clinical experience with whether or not that is effective in your opinion?
Yeah, so keto can be quite effective in particular types of cancer, cancers that are fueled predominantly by glucose. And brain cancer is one of those, some forms of colon cancer, and breast cancer is a combination, but does have some research to support it. Keto and Mediterranean diets probably have the most research to behind being effective for breast cancer specifically. The difference with keto, and I do use it, and it is a part of some of my protocols depending on the client, but it's not something that I use ongoing. So it might be something we use in the interim, and I like to stage things anyway because your body changes and does different things. But if we're trying to reduce blood sugar levels, insulin or insulin-like growth factor, then the keto diet or lose some excess weight or bring down inflammation in the body, the keto diet can be really effective for some people. The thing with keto is that you also have to understand what kidney function and liver function and all those other organs are doing, because it can be quite heavy on the kidneys specifically. And I suppose it's not as easy to follow as the Mediterranean diet. There can be some resistance there. You have to be 100% dedicated and measure your ketones and, you know, sometimes keep diet diaries and checking that you are having the right foods. So, yes, I use it. Yes, it can be very effective, but it's not something that I tend to use long term.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And what about intermittent fasting? Because that's the other one that often comes up in relation to cancer prevention, cancer treatment.
Yeah.
Do you use much intermittent fasting in your clinic?
Yeah, absolutely, I do. And as far as having, you know, some really specific protocols that apply to everybody, intermittent fasting is one of them. And, it's incorporating that into your daily routine. So having your last meal at 6 or 7 and then waiting between 12 and 16 hours to have your next meal. And the research supports 12 to 16 hours. I think 14 to 16 is maybe a little bit more effective. But again, it's giving people some boundaries, and most clients find that it's quite an achievable thing to add into their daily lifestyle, something that all the family can do, lots of research to support it, and also fasting prior to chemotherapy. There's some really strong research to support fasting before chemo, and whether that's again 12 to 16 hours, 16 to 20 hours, because in that state your cancer cells are already weak and tired and depleted, and to then give them that big onslaught of the toxic chemotherapy is showing to be helps with the efficacy of what the chemo is trying to do.
That's really interesting. I like that. And what about this? I just thought of this one too. What about coffee? Is that something, coffee and alcohol? Because I'm playing devil's advocate here. I'm like, what are all the things people would ask? And I feel like those things you'd get asked a lot would be coffee and alcohol.
Yes. Yeah. Big time. And you know what? Probably cheese. I think coffee and cheese are the two of the hardest things for, and it's that look, they're like, tell me, do I have to give up cheese? And just like, do I have to give up coffee? I can give up alcohol. And most people will say that. I can, like, alcohol's a no brainer. I can do that. But, you know, coffee is something that we're quite attached to because it's that, or it feels like it's nurturing. It's part of that morning routine. Look, coffee, I'm not too hard on if it's a nice organic, straight coffee. So not adding, or you can have like a nut milk or a soy milk, but no dairy and not adding sugar, one a day. If that really, once you're through treatment and, if it's something that you really enjoy and is going to bring you some happiness, then, you know, a coffee a couple of times a week, a few times a week is fine. And alcohol, obviously, is inflammatory and it's toxic to our bodies. So it's not something that I recommend in the diet, in anyone's diet.
Yeah. Yep. Good clarification. I like it. So moving a little bit away from food and onto supplements, this is another, I feel very hot topic, for lack of a better word, especially when it comes, I mean, it's irrelevant whenever we're treating anything, but particularly in relation to cancer, I feel like there's a lot of information out there that is contradictory around taking antioxidants, not taking antioxidants. You can take supplements with chemo. You can't touch anything with chemo. What's your experience in relation to using supplements alongside therapies such as chemotherapy and radiotherapy? Is there a place for them?
Oh, absolutely. There is a place for them. It's about understanding the chemotherapy drug itself, because they all work slightly differently. And there are some nutrients which have major interactions with the absorption of the chemo, where it may reduce the body's ability to use it, or it may accelerate their clearance. So understanding which of those supplements are, understanding, and look, I'm not an oncologist and I'm not an expert in chemotherapy. That's not my area, but I do have a pretty good understanding of the mechanism of action, how they're metabolized and what their half-life is, so that we can supplement outside of those parameters to reduce that risk of having any interactions or doing any harm, which is first and foremost of what we do. But look, I think the last stats were about 55% of oncology patients are using some form of natural medicine, but only a very small percentage of them are communicating that with their oncologist because of, and this is feedback I have received, it's not me making it up, is that they're afraid, they're nervous to talk about seeing a naturopath or seeing a nutritionist and wanting to supplement their bodies through treatment. So I communicate to oncologists, so each client, if we're going to be supplementing through chemotherapy or radiation therapy, I introduce myself and explain what we're doing complementary to their treatment and why. And that takes that role away. You know, it relieves that sense of stress or anxiety around a client having to have that conversation with their oncologist. But then they also feel, what would be the word? They feel comfortable that their oncologist is aware, and then we work together, which is really nice. And it doesn't always happen. But where there are a few oncologists that I see quite a few of their clients, so you build up that rapport. But yes, definitely NAT supplementation through chemotherapy with particular supplements to help reduce short-term side effects, but also looking at those long-term toxicities from some of these medications and trying to prevent those so that post-treatment there aren't any long-term health issues as a side effect of chemotherapy.
Yeah. So what are some examples of some of the ones you might use during chemotherapy to reduce side effects? And obviously this goes without saying, well, no, I will say it, but it's not prescriptive advice for everyone listening, but just what are some of the frequent flyers you might find yourself prescribing regularly to patients going through chemo?
Yeah, sure. So fish oils is one of them, or omega-3 fish oils. They have anti-inflammatory actions. They also can have actions where they help the efficacy of the chemotherapy, and they help protect the healthy cells. So in many instances, omega-3 fish oils will be supplemented. I use magnesium or a combination of a magnesium and some B vitamins through chemo to help with energy levels, to help with sleep, fatigue and stress and anxiety. And when we're going through, which you would know, any sort of stressful chronic condition or treatment, we deplete ourselves. Our bodies become depleted in some of those nutrients. So being able to top them up is beneficial. And look, probably one other that I could mention is curcumin. And that's also with some chemotherapies can be a chemo sensitizer. So helps with the efficacy of what the chemotherapy is trying to do. And other than that, it depends on the chemotherapy. There are some where some antioxidants are indicated, vitamin C, vitamin E, vitamin A, vitamin D is another one. And vitamin D is something that I do prescribe a lot because majority of women with breast cancer are quite low or depleted in their vitamin D levels. And that's a vitamin that we need to be getting up over that level of 100, which is protective and also can be helpful with outcomes post-chemotherapy. So there are probably a few. Yeah.
Oh, gosh, I don't know about you, but I feel like every second person, if not every person I see in clinic, has low vitamin D. It's just crazy. And I don't know if you find this as well, but often it's low and they've gone back to the doctor to get their results and the message is everything's fine, until it's like real bottomed out, like you better get yourself out in the sunshine right now kind of bad. But I see levels of like 30, 40, 50 just going unfazed, like, no, not an issue.
Yeah.
I just think, oh my goodness, like we need to be supplementing. And I often just recommend as a general thing, check your vitamin D levels every 6 months. It's not always will doc, sometime, I mean, everyone comes up against different barriers, but even if you have to pay out of pocket for it, it's really not that expensive and it's something that's worthwhile knowing about, especially because we know it has such key roles in so many different areas and is such a good preventative for so many different conditions. Oh,
absolutely. So absolutely.
One of my pet peeves.
Yeah, it's one of mine as well. And it's something that's being added to a lot of my clients' pathology slips. We by oncologists now, a couple of them. I think it's that one vitamin that is getting its well due time in the spotlight by many doctors, and understanding the influence that it has on prevention as well as recurrence.
Absolutely.
And it's so easy to test, isn't it? And it's so easy to supplement. However, in saying that, you would always, you know, don't go out and just grab vitamin D and have, you know, 5 or 6 or 10,000 international units every day. You'd want to get your blood tested and have a professional recommend what doses. And same with the nutrients I mentioned before. You would never take those on your own without guidance, because, you know, they can interact with certain chemotherapies, and you need to understand what that safe gap is to be having them.
Absolutely. Good advice. Now, what about non-food and non-supplement aspects to treating or healing breast cancer? So, you know, I know that we kind of alluded to just not getting exposure to excess xenoestrogens a little bit before in terms of decreasing your toxic load. But I guess something that I'd like to touch on a little bit more, so outside of just kind of decreasing your toxic load, which Kate and I have spoken about many, many times on the podcast before, but what I'm interested in is, you know, trauma and emotions and that side. Is that something you feel is an important part of this journey?
Oh, it's a huge part of this journey, and there's so much to be learnt. I wish I was younger and had more time to study some more, because this is a component to what I do, which I would love to be able to add in. And I think many people see kinesiologists, which can help with this from a physical perspective, where your body's holding on to memories or negativity in deep into the cells. And I don't understand fully kinesiology. I have the utmost respect for that modality, but the feedback I have is that helps considerably for a lot of people. But if you think about any chronic condition, there's always going to be that emotional component, because our body isn't just physical, it's emotional, physical, spiritual, and it works all together. And with breast cancer, and this is just my observation from the women I've seen over the years, is that women who are diagnosed with breast cancer are the most beautiful of people, and they give so much to everybody else and not enough to themselves. And that, again, there's no research, or, well, there might be, but I'm just saying from my own clinical experience, they're very, you know, and whether it's, and I guess if you think about the breasts are nurturing, you know, they were designed to feed children, nurturing, giving. And I think that majority of women, and we have tears, lots of tears when we talk about this, because there's always something that someone can identify with, whether it be 2, 3, or 5 years ago in their life, whether it is a trauma, whether it is a loss, whether it and whether that was physical or emotional, but tends to be something emotional tends to be the loss of a mother or a partner or a child, but something that is unresolved.
Yeah, I just think I'm with you. I haven't done any like formal further training in that aspect of things, but boy, do I see it being true in my experience personally and professionally. And I just think, you know, it makes sense. And we actually interviewed Jin Ong on the podcast not too long ago, talking about psychosomatic therapy and emotions being stored in the body and how to release them and the importance of addressing them. And I just think it's the kind of stuff that should just be taught throughout our whole lives, of how to really feel properly, release properly, and constantly address trauma as it comes up. But, you know, it's easier said than done, obviously, and that's why it's so important to have people on your team when, you know, in a very shared cared approach, as you're saying. And I feel you in that need to just like, I wish I had more. Where are all the hours in the day of all the things I want to learn, right?
Yeah, it really, it is. It's that part, you know, and as we're growing up, we're generally taught the right things to eat, that we need to exercise, we need to sleep. So diet, sleep, you know, whether we, how much of that we take on at different stages of our life is all individual. Our parents try to impart that knowledge at school. You know, we learn a little bit about it, but where do we learn about how exactly, how to feel, how it's okay to feel, how it's okay to be angry, how it's okay to let it out, but to let it out, to express it, and different ways to do that. We're not necessarily taught that from our parents. We're not necessarily, well, I was certainly wasn't taught that at school. And it's something that it is something that takes a bit of time to learn, and everyone will do that at their rate and do it differently. So it's a huge part. I think it's a huge part of, and Jin, I mean, Jin, this is her area. And when I've listened to her, I think, gosh, that's just so, it's so clever, but it's so, why don't we know this? Why don't we know how to help heal ourselves when something like that happens?
Yeah, I'm so glad that it's, you know, part of what you bring to people's awareness, because I just think it's so important. And, you know, sometimes the low-hanging fruit is nutrition and movement, but often I see it as a doorway to doing a lot of the other work as well, you know. It's just really interesting as well. So what I want to ask you now is, what are some of the common myths that you'd like to bust when it comes to breast cancer? Because I'm sure, Shannon, that you have some that you're just like, this again. So maybe what are 2 to 3 that come up often that you just want to address here for everyone to hear?
We touched on one before, which was, or we sort of danced around a little bit. The number one inquiry, or if I have, because I offer complimentary phone calls, so that, because I think it's really important for people to feel a connection or have some rapport with their health practitioners. So I think it's nice to have a chat and see if I'm the right fit. And the couple of the key questions that I get asked a lot, one of them is, I'm about to start treatment, so I'll come and see you at the end of my treatment, because I've been told I can't do both. I can't take any supplements through my chemotherapy or my radiation treatment. So that's when I really wanted to bust, because the best outcomes come from having your team of health practitioners assembled from the get-go. So as soon as you have that diagnosis, which is easy to say because it's overwhelming and there's so much going on emotionally and physically, that it certainly might not be top of mind, but even you can. I've had some clients whose best friends and family members have found me to work with them because it wasn't something they had the capacity to do at that moment, but they felt it was something important for them to get onto. So, if you can support your healthy cells through conventional treatments, the outcomes for your health and the outcomes for the efficacy, even perhaps for the chemotherapy, may be improved, but definitely your health and well-being through treatment and beyond are going to be are going to most probably have a better outcome than just conventional treatment alone. And that doesn't just include naturopathy. You know, as we talked about, that might be a counsellor, might be psychology, might be kinesiology, might be acupuncture. But having that team assembled as soon as you can, you absolutely can do both.
Love it. That's a good one. I really like that. All right, hit us with number two.
Okay, number two, and you touched on this a little bit before as well, and I don't want to bag the medical system at all, but being told that you can eat what you want through chemotherapy.
Mm.
Okay, it's an easy thing to say, but the long-term health outcomes, reducing inflammation in your body and feeding your body and your cells with all those key nutrients through chemotherapy is just going to have such an impact on your immune function in recovery long term. Also to help reduce potentially some of those drivers of the cancer with things like insulin and insulin-like growth factor. That's a big one. And the other side to that is that weight gain through chemo, which can happen when you're on steroids and other medications. And once that starts bumping up to a level that's then creating more inflammation in the body, it's just counterproductive. So as much as you might feel okay, I really encourage everyone to, make those bone broths or vegan broths and protein balls and snacks and things and healthy nutrient-rich meals to have through their chemo.
Yeah, absolutely. And any other ones? Like maybe we've got time for one more if you have one more up your sleeve.
Oh, the other one, the other most common question or fear is I can't have soy. If I have a hormonally driven condition, comes up with prostate cancer too. I've been told that soy could have caused my breast cancer or will contribute to recurrence if I eat soy. Is that true? And look, soy is one of the most genetically modified products in the world, and so avoiding non-organic soy, absolutely, but organic soy-based products, soy milk, tofu, tempeh, are all very safe. They are not linked to causing breast cancer, as may have been thought many, many years ago, and in fact can be protective.
Interesting. I'm learning new things. I love that. I think it just can be so confusing for people. Every person saying do one thing, there's someone else saying do something else. And I find that in relation to thyroid stuff as well. And it's really about just having someone to support you in making, the choices that are right for you right now based on where you're at and your context, your body. And I think that's just so important. So speaking of having someone like that, where can people find you and what offerings do you have at the moment?
Yes, so well in Melbourne we're in lockdown, so I am doing video calls, consults and phone consults, so it's business as usual, just modifying the approach through a screen rather than seeing people in person, which it's not the same, it's not ideal, but we can get there. Business as usual. My clinic is in Panton Hill in Victoria, which is about 40 kilometers northeast of Melbourne, and so hopefully get back into clinic maybe towards the end of the year or early next year and be able to start seeing people in person again. Otherwise I can be reached. I have a website and Facebook page under the Naturopathic Balance, which is the name of my clinic, and you can book online there. As I said, I like to do the complimentary phone calls if someone's unsure, so that they can ask questions and suss me out a bit and see if I'm the right fit or if I can recommend someone else who could be.
So good. I love that. And I'll make sure that all of those links are in the show notes as well. And I just want to say a big thank you for coming on and educating us on a topic that is often not spoken about until it's like too late, so to speak. So I really love that we've kind of broken down a few things in relation to breast cancer. And thank you for doing the work you do in the world.
Thank you. I really enjoy. I really enjoy what I do, and being able to support women through their diagnosis. And, you know, Nat, even this year I've had a bunch of beautiful women who have hit their 5-year, you know, all clear marks. And it's amazing. It makes it, you know, I love it. I love what I do. And if I can help and support, those through their breast cancer diagnosis, then yeah, I feel like that's what I'm meant to be doing.
So good. So good. Well, thank you. Guys, one more thing before you go that I really wanted to share with you, and that is that Shannon has a number of exciting initiatives for 2021. To help further support women experiencing a breast cancer diagnosis, she has developed a couple of specific organic herbal teas to provide support for nausea, fatigue, and nervous system support through chemo and radiation treatments. She will be talking at a number of breast cancer support groups, and she's so very excited to announce a webinar that Shannon is releasing February 4th called A Breast Cancer Diagnosis and Beyond. Shannon put this together with deep caring and knowledge from her years of clinical hands-on experience with her breast cancer clients. It has been created to help provide guidance and support for anyone diagnosed with breast cancer and their family, partner, and friends, a kind of navigating tool through your diagnosis. Shannon will be releasing more information around the webinar in the following weeks, so jump on over to her Instagram and Facebook pages or email Shannon directly at shannoncarlin@bigpond.com. I'll make sure that all of that information is in the show notes, but if all else fails, please make sure that you follow her on Instagram, as I'm sure she'll be sharing so much more there. And finally, hopefully it goes without saying, but I will never make assumptions that this information shared in the podcast is for educational purposes only. And any changes to supplements, to diet, to anything health related should be run through your practitioner first. So I hope you enjoyed the chat. I certainly did. And it feels really good to be starting more of these conversations around what can otherwise be overwhelming and scary topics. So I will see you all next week. We'll be right back.